Neighbor Radio, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Susan, thank you.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hello out there, this is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial, unless your FM was made in America.
KBOO Community Radio proudly co-sponsors the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on Thursday, July 17th from 6 p.m. until 1 a.m. at Holocene, located at 1001 Southeast Morrison. This fundraiser opens with an ocean art show and silent auction, followed by a screening of the surf film Seven Signs. Then the reggaetronic five-piece band Everyday Profits takes center stage at 10 p.m. Again, that's the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on July 17th. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for an IT contractor to work with our organization 15 hours a week at $25 an hour. Providing on-site IT support as well as website maintenance support. Essential qualifications include at least 5 years of general IT network and server maintenance and website administration, experience with PHP, MySQL, experience in Drupal 6 and 7, ability to maintain rack-mounted server and maintain a local area network of Windows XP, 7, and 8 workstations. Send a resume and cover letter addressing the above qualifications and the question, why KBOO is important, to hiring@kboo.org or drop it off for IT Hiring Team at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. More information can be found at kboo.fm/hiring.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Karen James. My guest is Mary Graham, who will talk about her journey from prison to healing and hope. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your journey by starting with what you are doing today.
My life today is taking the negative and turning it into a positive. It's the driving force that keeps me clean and sober and helping others.
And what do you do to help others?
Recently, I was a mentor for Washington County and a house manager. I'm moving on from that. I'm not quite sure what the next chapter in my life's going to be, but I know it's going to be great.
Talk about your recovery today.
I'd like to start at the beginning where it all started, if you don't mind. Back when I was in my teens, and I was a methamphetamine user. Basically, I used anything that there was to use, but meth was what I did most. one day I was walking, it was a summer day, and I was walking on Union. I'd been up for a couple weeks, strung out, no money, no dope, no people, no nothing, and I was in that desperation. So in that desperation, I had heard a couple blocks away singing, and the singing drawed me to them. Now, if you're familiar with Union in the summertime, the blacks put up a tent on Fremont, and this is where I was drawn to. And so when I looked inside the tent, I noticed that everybody was black in there, and my first thought was they're probably not going to allow me in here because I was dirty, stinky, and just a mess. I looked inside the tent, and there was a chair right by the door, so I took that first seat, and I figured, my thinking was that I could run. If they try to kick me out, I could book out of there. So anyway, the pastor, he came down from his stand at the front of the stage, and he was walking towards me, and I could remember thinking that this is where I was going to get the boot. But I didn't move. I just stayed there. And this man came down, and he put his hand on my head, and he prayed. And to this day, I can't tell you what he said, but I know what I said. And I was like, if there's anything out there, if you truly exist, get me away from the drugs, because I could not stop. And that was my prayer. About 10 minutes later, after I had left that tent and I was walking down Union, the Red and Blues were on full blast, and I was arrested. I was taken to Multnomah County, and I went in front of Judge Haggerty. And there's rumors about Judge Haggerty, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I guess he had lost a child to addiction. And so he was a no-mess-around judge.
And Mary, what year are we talking about?
We're talking about 1991. And so when I went in front of him, I remember him sentencing me to 6 months of prison. And I was devastated because I was thinking, well, I'm not that bad. I'm just a drug addict, you know.
Had you committed a crime?
In my eyes, no. But towards society, using drugs is a crime. So, yes, I had. I couldn't stop. I had lost my children. I had four beautiful daughters that my rights were terminated. And I was trying to kill the pain. You know, I had messed up as a mother. And so they were gone. And so when I got sentenced to the Oregon Women's Penitentiary down in Salem. I remember being shackled around the waist, around the wrist, and around my feet. And I was chained to other women and put in this bus. And we were driven down to Salem, in which I was put into a dorm setting. And I had the top bunk. And I remember jumping down from the top bunk to the floor to use the restroom. And there was a girl in the bunk underneath me, and she was reading a Bible. And I kind of gave her a kind of a kick when I jumped down, like, and a dirty look. And I said, there ain't no God. And she stopped me, and she said, hey, wait a minute. She goes, what do you mean, you know? And I told her the story about the tent and the prayer, and look where I'm at. I'm in prison, and so there ain't no God. And she just said to me, don't you see? And I couldn't even argue with her. Sometimes the lessons that I learned from that is sometimes God does for you what you can't do for yourself. And the second lesson I learned was it doesn't always come packaged how I think it's going to come. And so from that point forward, I knew there was something out there. And when I was released from, I got transferred from OW, Oregon Women Penitentiary, to Columbia River Correctional Institution, to the Turning Point Treatment Center. I did treatment for 5 months out of that six, trying to save my children, thinking that if I did that, that I would get a second chance, which didn't happen for me. My rights were terminated. But I remember it being release date, and I was getting down to some core issues, and I wasn't going to stick around to finish it. Release date, open the gate, I'm gone.
So you did not complete the Turning Point treatment program?
I did complete it as far as their requirements, but I had opened some wounds deep inside of me with their treatment, and it was release date. So I used twice the amount of drugs I did before I went in.
Once you were released?
Yep. First place I went was the dope house.
Talk about the Turning Point program. It sounds as if there wasn't enough time for it to help you resolve your issues prior to release. Is that correct?
I don't think that's fair to say. I think it's a very good program, and it's just whether you're ready or not and where you're at in your life. And 20 years ago, I was 20 years old. I wasn't ready. You know, I had just lost my children, so I can't really say it's the treatment part. It was a good treatment. It got down to some core issues and taught you different coping skills. But at that point in my life, I wasn't there. I just wasn't there. And many of us aren't there the first round. I've been in 17 different treatment centers. I've been to jail. I've been to prison. So until it was time.
It wasn't time, Mary. I hear about people hitting bottom. Is that what needs to happen? Do people need to hit bottom? Is that when this time you are talking about takes place?
Good question. They talk about that we all have to hit bottoms, but in my experience, there's many bottoms. And so it's different for everyone. I know that a lot of family members want to try to rescue you and save you, and it just really doesn't work. There's a verse that I've learned about, you can lock us up, beat us, counsel us, nothing's going to work until we want it to. So what that time frame is different for everyone.
And when was that for you?
I've had a couple of them. Moving on with my story, I got clean in 94. So my prison time was 91, 92. Got out, used more drugs, 93. I got clean in 94 after losing everything, my children, everything, just being my sanity. So I got clean in 94, and I stayed clean till 2005. So I had 10 years, and I worked for the state of Oregon, vocational rehabilitation. I bought my own house. I bought my own car. I had everything money could buy you. My boyfriend turned into my husband. He was released from Oregon State Penitentiary. He'd been there 20 years. So when my journey began with all the drugs was when he was first taken away at age 18, and I had his baby. As I look back, what I know about that is I used more drugs, more men, more dope to try to fill this void I felt inside, and I never knew what that void is. I can tell you today I know what that void is. And that void is, to me, it's God hunger, which makes sense to me that nothing else could fill. But by God, I tried. I tried lots of other things and amounts to fill that void. So my husband was released in 2003. We were married. So he had done 20 years. And I'd like to say his name. It's Donald Harold Graham II. For those that knew him from doing a 20-year set, you know. One of my hopes is that his death doesn't go in vain is one of the things that promotes me to do this story. When Donald got out, I was able to provide the house, the car, and even a job for him. As I look back, I kind of wonder if that was really the right thing to do because Donald didn't have to work for it. It was all given to him. in which it didn't mean that much to him. And so I think I kind of robbed him of those things that we earn and we feel good about. I provided it all for him.
You were the rescuer.
Yes. And in society today, it was almost as if you had to have a rescuer because the prisoners are getting out. And if you've got a record, there's not even apartments that will rent to you. You know, so I had to go buy a house, which I'm grateful that I was able in that condition to do that. The job, trying to find a job and having a record is very difficult, you know. I had a friend that laid carpet, and it was his own business. So I got my husband hooked up with that, and he did really well. The first year was really good. There was things going on with Donald that I didn't know, and that he tried to tell me, and I didn't realize what he was saying at the time. But he said things to me like, the lights, the city lights. I have to go see the city lights. He wouldn't come home at night. He was out on the bluff, the gorge, looking at the city lights. He was attracted to the city lights. Behind the walls of Oregon State Penitentiary, you don't see any lights. And he was in there for 20 years. So there was things like that that he was going through that he didn't really know how to communicate. There was just different things going on with him. And him marrying me right when he got out. I was there when he fell, and I was there when he got out. But what we both didn't realize is that he didn't grow up emotionally and mentally. And so the second year, he left me for a stripper that was 20 years old, the same age as our daughter. But really, that's where he was emotionally and mentally, from being behind the walls, you know. So it was, I understood, but I was hurt. So it was a whole bunch of, it was messed up. And the third year, Clackamas County Sheriff took his life. And again, there was many things there that he tried to tell me. He had left me 8 months prior to his death. But 2 days before his death, he called me up and he was like, Mary, pick me up. I said, okay. So I went and picked him up and drove around with him for 2 days. Donald Graham was this prideful ego, big man on campus, I guess would be a good way to describe it. Anybody that knew him at Oregon State Penitentiary was like, you don't mess with Donnie Graham. But this man, for the 2 days before his death, listened to all my whining and moaning and yelling, and he would never even give me 10 minutes, but for 2 days he listened to me. And I look back now, and I think it's because he knew he was going to go. He was very sorry. He said sorry 1,000 times, and at that time I didn't know what all those sorries were meaning. He said things like, Mary, did you know that suicide takes a different kind of courage? And I remember thinking, that's crazy. Don't talk like that. But again, when I look back, he was trying to warn me. He said things like, I won't go back. He would rather die than go back. So I don't know exactly all what transpired in that 20 years of his life being locked up inside, but he'd rather die than go back.
So it was suicide by cop.
Well, getting into the beginning of this interview, we talked about turning my negative into hope. And this has been a process for me, and it's been in my recovery through the 12 steps. I was very angry with the cops. I called them a bunch of murderers. I was with Donald that night that he died. He was shot in the back, and he had no weapon. He was not armed. First, I was angry. I was murdered by cops, and I worked the 12 steps, and the first layer of the onion came off, and then it was suicide by cop was my second layer. Then that layer came off, and if I want somebody to blame, or I'm looking for the cause of his death, what really, really, truly it is, it's the disease of addiction. They talk about the disease of addiction being cunning and baffling, and that's exactly what it was. It was so cunning and baffling that it took his life and had me blaming everybody else while I was doing drugs too. So it was ready to take me out. That's the cunning, baffling part of it. And when I realized that, I was, well, okay.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. And my guest is Mary Graham, and we're talking about her journey from prison to healing and hope. Mary, how did your husband's death affect you?
The way it affected me was in a very negative way. I dove back into the drugs with 10 years clean and sober. As soon as I picked up, it was like I'd never stopped. I could not do enough drugs or dope to kill the pain. Mentally, I thought that if I didn't accept the death, then it didn't happen. I used for 5 years on that until I tried to die out there and nobody would kill me. And so I got clean. I put myself into a treatment center, which I spent 5.5 months inpatient.
You entered a treatment center on your own?
Well, I had gotten busted again for many possession charges. I think the last number count I had was 12. But when I got put on probation in Multnomah County, the caseloads are so huge. They had 600 clients per probation officer. So it was basically you went to a group orientation. They told you, you know what you've been sentenced to, and this is the time frame you've got to complete it. And I had 18 months to complete a drug treatment package. So I, as a homeless person, was on my bike, and I rode every week from 106th to 182nd trying to get into this treatment center. Whether I was high or not, I did it. And that was my willingness, too, to get in, to change. And the good part of, for me, my story, is that with having the 10 years clean and sober that I had before, and being out for 5 years, at least I knew what worked and what to go back to. So I wasn't a newcomer. I wasn't fresh at this thing. I knew what worked.
I hear that that is when people do have some time in recovery and are not using, and then go back to using, they can't compare, they can't see the difference. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I had 10 years clean and sober. The pain was so great that I picked up the needle and the drugs again and tried to drown out my sorrow and misery. I didn't want to feel. I didn't want to feel anymore. I didn't want to cope and accept reality.
And that reality being the loss of your husband and giving up your 4 daughters.
Yep.
Mary, are your daughters in your life today?
I have 4 beautiful daughters, and they are my best friends. And I know these are more signs of a higher power being present, because it overexceeds any judge, any termination of rights. I'm still a mother to 4 daughters, even though the state of Oregon said I wasn't. I would like to talk about where the hope comes in through doing the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. It can be Alcoholics Anonymous. It can be Celebrate Recovery. It can come straight out of the Bible, whatever you choose. In my recovery, since I got clean again.
Right now, how long have you been in recovery?
I just celebrated 4 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So talk about your recovery.
Yeah.
What works for you?
I really want to share with everybody what happened after the 12th step, because it's not something I planned or I ever dreamed would ever happen. Anyway, I completed the 12th step, and I had just completed Clean Slate in Multnomah County, trying to clean up some of the wreckages and the money and the fines that I owed for all my charges. And so I was headed downtown Portland to the courthouse on the TriMet bus, and it was the first time I can ever remember being happy and excited to go to court, because I've never been happy and excited to go to the courthouse. So I went through a bunch of emotions on the TriMet bus headed down, and first I was happy, and then I was sad, and I started crying, and my tears, I was trying to get in touch with why I was sad and why I was crying on the bus, and it was because it really wasn't that hard to do the next right thing and clean up all my wreckage. And here I was going down, graduating clean slate, and I was reflecting on my husband's death that it really wasn't that hard to do the right thing, and he doesn't get to do that. Then I went straight into anger. I was angry at him. Why'd you check out and not do this simple thing that I'm doing?
All of this on the bus.
All of this on the bus, on the ride down. So I got down to downtown Portland, and I graduated, and when the judge stuck his hand out to shake my hand, I grabbed him by the neck, and I hugged him. This is part of my healing, my journey healing, with my concept of thinking judges and cops were murderers and bad people, and they were out to get me. This is where some of my turnaround started. When I hugged the judge, I only had to do one day of community service that excused hundreds and hundreds of dollars that I owed the county. To me, that was a true blessing. From that point, I had gone to a meeting at the Northwest Alano Club. And when I'd walked in, the chairperson was chairing about awareness. He was talking about awareness. And right after he got done speaking, I chimed in and talked about my journey on the bus down and all the feelings that I had gone through and da-da-da-da. When I got done sharing, there was this man. The chairperson called on him. His name was Matthew. And he asked Matthew if he'd like to share. And Matthew, as we were all waiting for Matthew to share, he couldn't talk. And he started to cry. And we all sat in silence watching what was going on with this guy. We didn't know. And this guy said, you know, usually I'm very articulate with my words when I share. And he said, after listening to Mary, I'm having a hard time doing that. And this man just broke out bawling his head off. And we all sat there. We all didn't know what was wrong or what was going on. When he was finally able to speak, he said, I am a Clackamas County Sheriff, and I have 5 days clean. And I was just in awe. It talked about the spiritual awakening after step 12. When was I going to get mine? I was thinking, well, I was getting mine right there. This man that shared this, the meeting went on as meetings do. Afterwards, I mean, I sat there the whole time in my head going, was he the cop that killed my husband? Was he part of it? I mean, I had all these questions in my head going flying. What I knew in my recovery is that one addict helping another is without parallel. And it was my responsibility with a person that had 2 years at that time to go to the addict that still suffers, that it only had 5 days. So it didn't really matter what he was, what I was, what had happened, anything. And I got up and I went over and I hugged this man, and it was the strangest hug ever, because in my mind, cops are big, burly, powerful. When they pull you over, you're shaking so bad because you know they have that power over you and you're going to jail. That's not what I felt in my arms. It was totally the opposite. I felt this fragile human bone body in my arms, and I was in awe. And then when me and him shared with each other, I explained to him about the onion, the layers that had come off with me thinking they were murderers, with them thinking it was suicide by a cop, by me knowing that it was actually the disease of addiction that took him out. And this man again cried. And he said, thank you for sharing that with me. And I asked him, were you the officer at my husband's shooting? And he said, no, I wasn't, but I know of the incident. And then he explained to me about how another person had shot a gun at him and the bullet was 3 inches away from his head. Not only was he terrified, but it was his job. And he shot back and he killed the man. And he says, there's not a day that goes by that I don't have to live with this. And he says, and as you can tell, I'm not doing very well with 5 days clean. And that was one of my turning points of, oh my God, police officers are human too. I didn't know that. I honestly did not know that. But I was shown that. I felt that. I gave him a hug and he walked away. I had a friend with me in recovery. I looked at him and I said, did that just happen? And he said, yeah, Mary, that just happened. So since then, I have had all kinds of, I choose to call them God shots. I was hired as a house manager at Bridges to Change. I've gone through about 250 women living with me. I love them dearly, all of them, all the different personalities and shapes and sizes of women. I love them. I was also had the privilege of being a mentor in Washington County for 6 months and met a whole bunch more women. So working side by side in the jails, having badges, going into both counties, I've learned a lot. I've seen people all working for the common good, and it was nothing like I had thought in my addiction. So my thinking has changed dramatically. What I witnessed with my own eyes is people just wanting us to quit hurting ourselves and hurting others is the main point of it all. My hope to anybody that might be listening is to